Hare Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Saha Viryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavaditamastu Tama vidvishavahai Om Shanti 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 Om Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Okay. In this age of quarrel and hypocrisy, the only means of deliverance is chanting of the holy name of the Lord. There is no other way, there is no other way, there is no other way. Simply by chanting the holy name of the Lord, one advances perfectly in spiritual life. This is the best process for success in life. In other ages, the chanting of the holy name is equally powerful. But especially in this age, Kali Yuga, it is most powerful. Kirtanad eva krishnasya muktasangaf paran. Param Vrajet, Srimad Bhagavatam 12.351. Simply by chanting the holy name of Krishna, one is liberated and returns home back to Godhead. Therefore, even if one is unable to perform other processes of devotional service, one must adopt the chanting of the holy name as the principal method of advancing in spiritual life. Yagyai Sankirtana Praya Yajanti Hi Sumedasa. Srimad Bhagavatam 11.5. 32. Those who are very sharp in their intelligence should adopt this process of chanting the holy names of the Lord. One should not, however, manufacture different types of chanting. One should adhere seriously to the chanting of the holy name as recommended in the scriptures. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Because some people like to make their own system. At the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, then one very famous Babaji, for some reason, just started made up his own chant like that. It's names, but they put it together in their own way. But this is the mantra that comes from Goloka. So this is the original mantra, right? From this comes the Kama Gayatri, comes all the other mantras like that. But so the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra is the original, like that. So this is what they chant, you know, in Vrindavan. Yes.
Is it a traditional chant?
You know what I'm saying?
I'm not sure. Like sometimes we hear some mantras that
No, but is the kirtan person making them up?
That I don't know. Sometimes it's like.
Yeah, but I'm saying if you don't know enough, then how are you going to ask? Because I can't answer your question. You know what I'm saying? They may be singing a song from one of the acharyas or something that you don't know. You know what I'm saying? In other words, one doesn't make up one's own mantras, right? It's not important. Like, devotees to make up their own songs. Prabhupada didn't feel it was very important. Right? We have our own tradition, so we just follow that. It works. Is that okay? Okay. While chanting the holy name of the Lord, one should be careful to avoid 10 offenses. From Sanat Kumar, it is understood that even if a person is a severe offender in many ways, he is freed from offensive life if he takes shelter of the Lord's holy name. Indeed, even if a human being is no better than a two-legged animal, he will be liberated if he takes shelter of the holy name of the Lord. One should therefore be very careful not to commit offenses at the lotus feet of the Lord's holy name. The offenses are described as follows. A. To blaspheme a devotee, especially a devotee engaged in broadcasting the glories of the holy name of the Lord. Right, so here it's just saying a devotee. So one should avoid saying bad things about devotees, let alone someone who's preaching. Right, because the Lord's preaching potency, the chit potency, comes through the preacher. Right, that's how it's delivered to the conditioned souls. Because somebody's preaching it. Right, so that's what makes it work. So therefore, one who carries the holy name and gives it to others, one should be very careful about, you know, making comments. Yes.
So, what is the definition of preaching?
What's the definition of preaching?
To speaking.
It's the same, as long as the point is someone who is influencing others' lives to take up the process, then that's what we're talking about.
Definition of blaspheming.
Definition of blaspheming means how far can you go?
I'm thinking.
You know, can you call him a dweeb? Is that okay? You know. But if you call him an idiot, okay, now that's obvious. But then, you know, what about a geek? You know, nerd. You know.
As a bad seeker, I'm thinking. Yeah. If sometimes we encounter devotees who we may think is out of line in some situation. So how to go about this? You know.
How to go about this?
Yeah,
what is this?
It could be anything. Yeah, taking prasad in the temple room or something. So we go to an authority, and sometimes it's difficult because I get in my case, sometimes I keep quiet and I'm not sure if I should actually act or say something.
Depends on if you can have effect.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Means pointing out something in the process that could be improved, then that's fine.
Mm.
But one should also be very careful that there might be the element of we may not understand the full aspects of it. So that's why we point it out, but we point it out with the idea that not that we're necessarily right, unless it's obvious.
Mm.
You know, but that it might be pointed out otherwise. But if we're attached to that we're right, that they're wrong, then you'll have a problem, because then you'll start arguing the point. So if you go to them and speak, then you speak, they'll say whatever they say. If it's something that can be adjusted, great. If it's something that can't, then don't push it. You go to authority, you're not going to work it out, you simply inform them, you know, and then don't worry about what happened. Because we're not dealing with it, there may have been other elements we don't know about.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So then we can't say, well, I told him he did nothing about it, you know, like that. Because if that's the case, then that would put us as the authority. We've told them they have to do it. Right? So in other words, self-realization is so nice that even if one just focuses just on oneself, it still works. Right? You know, it's not that only once we've made everybody else self-realized, then everything's nice for us, now we can relax and be self-realized.
The funny thing is sometimes it seems easier that way. But it
seems easier to get everybody else Krishna conscious.
To be focusing on everybody else instead of yourself.
Yeah, because if you focus on everyone else instead of yourself, you don't have to deal with your own false ego, just everyone else's, which is obvious that it shouldn't be there, right? You know, so therefore, you know, they should get over it, right?
You
know?
You get me.
Yeah. Yeah, like that. Okay. Anything else here on blaspheming devotees? I'm impressed. Okay, because this could be a 2-week discussion. B. To consider the name of Lord Shiva or any other demigod to be equally as powerful as the holy name of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. No one is equal to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, nor is anyone superior to him. Right, so that means no other names then would be considered to have any kind of you know, general potency. For generally for the Westerners, it's not a problem because the only names you've ever heard of are the ones that, you know, we generally come in contact with society. But if you're coming from, let's say, a Hindu background, there's plenty of other names. You know, so some of these, like, don't necessarily mean so much to us right now, but, you know, give it a few years, then it starts meaning something. Yes.
Mark, in the Upanishad, we learn about Chit. Achit and Ishwara. Yes. Where is Lord Shiva fit into that?
Chit, Achit and Ishwara. He is a subservient transformation of Ishwara. You know, like that. So you could say he's between Chit and Ishwara. Like that. You know what I'm saying? You know, and he's the top, and he still doesn't make it. So the demigods are just, they're powerful office holders, but they as an individual are exactly the same. Right? And since their office is empowered by the Supreme Lord, then they consider that there'll be some equal or greater benefit, then that's very foolish. If you think just, you know, the local minister, you know, the secretary has as much power as the prime minister, then that's a major mistake. Like that.
Can we get into the category of
can, but here it's not making any distinction. But you do have direct, which will be discussing Krishna in relationship to a devotee, and indirect, where it's talking about him as the Supreme. Like that. Yes.
Mars is a Jaya Pancha Tattva. Is that a Vishnu Tattva mantra?
Jaya Pancha Tattva.
Yes, at the end of Kirtan.
It depends upon how you're looking at it. Because you're looking at the Panchatattva as five personalities. It's not like Ishwara meaning the supreme or the controller. Here it's meaning the five categories of the Lord and his associates. Like that. Does that make sense?
So then we should chant that at the end of the first time.
It's not that we have to chant that as if it comes up. If it's being chanted, then we chant it. But it's not that it's a necessity, right? The spiritual master's pranam mantra, Panchatattva Mahamantra, and Hare Krishna Mahamantra, these are necessary, right? Mangalartik, you have the Guru Vastika, you know, evening artik, you have the Gaur artik. Other than that, no other mantras are necessary or mandatory. If they're being chanted, that's one thing, but they're not mandatory. Okay? C, to disobey the instructions of the spiritual master. Right? So he gives directions, and we're trying to follow that. If the detail can't be followed, the principle is what we're trying to follow. And even we're trying to follow the detail once you see it in line with the principle. Because without seeing it in line with the principle, we may miss the application, right? Get distracted by the detail and miss the point. D, to blaspheme the Vedic literatures and literatures compiled in pursuance of the Vedic literatures, right? So to say the Vedas don't apply means they're eternal. They always apply. Like that. Or literatures in pursuance of the Vedic version, which means the literatures of the Acharyas or something in pursuance of that. One doesn't say anything about that. So it's not that, oh, well, it's only Bhagavatam, nothing else. No, because Bhagavatam is the topmost literature, but the other literatures are also pointing out the same thing. Maybe not as directly. That's why Bhagavatam was compiled. But still, they're giving the same information. Right? Like that.
What?
Yes.
Is this also the category of these offerings, when one knows the injunctions of Shastra but neglects them purposefully?
Neglects them purposefully. Why would one neglect them purposefully?
Because of some material interest.
Material interest. So why did one read those Vedic literatures in the first place? You're supposed to repeat the same point. may be different. Why would it be different?
Somebody wants to be a devotee, but sometimes, like, he knows that his material interest is more important to him than those injunctions.
But what injunctions? If we're injunctions that Prabhupada's giving, what are the injunctions that we're missing out on? You know what I'm saying? But the Vedic literature is beyond that, then one will hear all kinds of injunctions. The point is why are you reading it in the first place? Because if there's a material consideration, one can't reconcile them. If it's actually spiritual, then there's not a problem. Does that make sense? That works?
So I was referring to like more spiritual instructions, because I find that this is also in category of these offerings. Like, we have some spiritual injunctions.
But what, where are these spiritual injunctions? You know what I'm saying? See, we have to be, means we're very careful to see that what does apply does apply. But we have to be very careful about, well, you know, externalizing everything and making it all into all these rules. That, you know what I'm saying? Because otherwise, it, as it said here, even a two-legged animal can chant. Right? He's a severe offender in many ways, but he can chant. But he should be careful about making offenses to the holy name. So generally speaking, you can find that devotees will try to take any offense anywhere and fit it into the tent. So there's no recourse. No one can be saved. You know what I'm saying? Because there's, you know, somehow or another standing around and, you know, waving placards and, you know, hellfire and brimstone and everyone's repent now, sinner, and all this kind of stuff, you know, for thousands of years, and it becomes quite deeply ingrained. You know what I'm saying? But the point is if these are avoided, then other things, you know, one can get around. You know what I'm saying? You know, one can purify them through the process of chanting. But we'll ritualize everything where there's nothing anywhere that doesn't fit. So you have to be very careful. It means you're, here it's talking about blaspheming the Vedic literature. So it doesn't mean that due to weakness of heart, you're not following. There's a difference between blaspheming and weakness of heart. But this is the problem, is we won't make these distinctions. So everybody is a sinner. Of course, except for ourselves. And all that. If you want details, he can tell you, you know, how the thing works. You know. Like that, right? That's what we were discussing before. Yeah, you know. How to point out everybody else's fault, how that, but you're, hey, you're liberal, right? You know, like that. Very, very, it means you're that proper balance between strictness and liberality, right? Very strict with everyone else, very liberal towards yourself, right? You know, so all these kind of, it works, right? Yeah. It's working, no? Okay. He's great. He's happy. He's happy. Of course, everyone else in the temple has a problem.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. That's it. How come they don't understand? You know, I'm only trying to help. You know? Does that make sense? So we have to be very careful about that because, you know, they're principles, but they're very specific. You know, blasphemy is one thing, weakness of heart is another. You know, if you're saying, no, we don't have to follow that, that's all fanatic and all, that's another thing, then that would be not dealing properly with the scripture. But it's a matter of, you know, it's there and you know it's correct, but you can't follow it, then that's weakness of heart. You know what I'm saying? And so either in the weakness of heart, meaning in the original, that there's the taste for the material, you know. Does that make sense? Or there's specific desires. Like that. Yes?
There's the same Portuguese, many points. There's one point in that, one point into God, and three to...
Oh, okay. At least there's the one to God. Americans put it kind of down. So you get two. Well, actually, there's you, and then there's a few mushrooms, right? You know, it's a few collateral damage there. Yes. Okay. It's not necessarily offensive. It means that we're not properly following. Because offenses is, in anartas, then offense is one category of four. And then you have weakness of heart, and then you have asatrishna, or attachment to particular material taste. Weakness of heart just means the underlying principle of I'm the controller and enjoyer. And it manifests in so many ways, but it's generic. It's not specific. Asatrishna means it's weakness of heart where it's taken on its second form, where you're specifically attached to a particular kind of material endeavor. Right? While the other one is just in general. Does that make sense? You know, it's just like, let's say you go to a... you're hungry, right? So you go to you know, where there's prasad, but you don't have any particular attachment. It's just the need to eat, right? But when you get there, then you'll see so many preparations, and this one you want, and that one. You understand? So there's two levels, what you're dealing with. So weakness of heart just means that there's the tendency towards, and then asatrishna means the specifics, right? So those aren't, that's not offense. You know what I'm saying? So we'll take that's what I was saying to him, is we'll take everything and turn it into offense. Because in your Western concept, there's only sin and that's it. There isn't anything else. There's no degrees or levels. You know, it's just, you know, everything will put you in hell eternally. But at the same time, is, you know, if you just accept, then you'll be reformed. So it's pretty far out. It's that, you know, you can do all this stuff. You can just do one thing and you'll spend eternally in hell, or you can spend a whole lifetime, and if you repent at the end, you're fine. So how to get that balance right, I'm not quite sure, because depending upon who it is, it seems to be quite subjective up to the, you know, who's viewing the situation, the individual, whether it's something that you can be saved or not. Does that make sense? So by that kind of habit, then we tend to not be able to see differences and levels. That's why something like Manu, then they will define the differences like that. And so that you have an idea of what has a lot of weight and what doesn't. You know, like, you know, if you kill an animal that has, you know, hairs on it, so for as many hairs on its body, then there's going to be a reaction, you know, and then generally what you have to do to get around that is quite serious. But it says you would require a cartload full, have killed a cartload full of boneless animals, right, to add up to, you know, one prayaschitta that you'd have to do. Does that make sense? So, you know, therefore it makes a distinction between, you know, an animal with bones and one without. Right? So if you killed the frog, you killed the worm, there's a difference. Like that. So that's what the Shastras point out. But we tend to, because we're coming from a culture that socially, ethically, morally, because there is no dharma, then, you know, there is no liberation. So, and sense gratification. So, basically you're dealing with sense gratification and artha. But it's purely whatever you feel like. You know, there's some vestiges that there's some kind of religious consideration. But those things aren't fixed. You know what I'm saying? Because where would the fixing come from? You know what I'm saying? Because it would have to be based on the Old Testament, if you're going to fix it. Because the New Testament is based on that. And so then, if you're not looking at that, then people make them up. So the problem comes is then we make up, we ourselves attribute how strong it is. Right? You know, because for one person, then there is... It depends upon where you applied. And one person then, you know, something in the kirtan that's not right, that's a really big grave offense. Someone else, it's not. Someone with prashad, it's a grave offense. Someone is not. Someone else in how you deal with Vaishnavas, and someone else is not. You know what I'm saying? So we make up our own standards. So that's the difficulty. You know? And then we'll take the particular Vedic element, but we won't interpret it, not interpret it, but understand it in its cultural context of application. We'll apply it into the Western, how the Western would define that word. And then because of that, then we run into a lot of problems. So that's why tradition is so important. Because tradition means the practice of the great personalities in the past. That's tradition. So we have this tendency to throw out tradition because it doesn't apply. You know, it's Kali Yuga, it's not being followed. But amazingly, you know, the four Kumaras are still following the culture that they talk about in the Vedic literatures today. And you come back after another, you know, 150 trillion years, and they'll still be following it. So this concept that something doesn't apply in principle is totally a misunderstanding. Details, that you have to change, that they'll say themselves. Vedic means the principle has to remain intact, the detail is applied to the time, place, and circumstance. That's a Vedic principle. Modern man tries to make it look like it's his. But modern man, it simply means what's economically or politically an advantage now. Not in the future, because they don't know Dharma. You have to know Dharma to know the future of, you know, Dharma, Artha, and Kama. If you don't know it, you can't tell what the future is. So they have no idea. So they work what works to now, and that's practical. So what they're talking about is ethics, as we said yesterday. What's right and wrong action for this situation to get done exactly what I want. But Dharma means you apply ethics so that they get done what you want in line with what will happen in the future also. That's the difference. So Yudhishthira, it's not that Yudhishthira doesn't follow ethics, but he follows it in line with Dharma. While Duryodhana just follows ethics straight. So he gets an immediate result. He got rid of Yudhishthira and the Pandavas. You know, but afterwards then he and all his brothers get killed. So that was a lack in Dharma. You know, ethics for the time, it worked great. But, you know, but because Yudhishthira also is using ethics, then when the time comes, Yudhishthira's application of ethics was better than his. Because his was in line with Dharma, so he had to wait for the right time. You know, when it's just Duryodhana and his brothers and a few others, then they get the upper hand. But when it's Yudhishthira and the whole army, then he doesn't quite have the same upper hand. You know what I'm saying? So this is the problem when the devotee says, I'm just being practical. Maybe they are, but there's also a chance maybe they're not. Maybe yes, in that situation, that would be the right and wrong for getting done the short-term goal you want to get. Yes. But if you're looking at a longer term, you might want to adjust it. So that's the point, is that's why one has to know all three of them. Right? Dharma, Artha, and Kama. Then that is based on liberation's higher than that, devotion's higher than that. So you don't want to compromise the retraction from the material, you know, and development of the devotional for Dharma, Artha, and Kama. Does that make sense? Means you're following Dharma, Artha, and Kama. So Dharma is your central principle. Then Artha has to be seen in light of that, and Kama in light, you know, from before. But those three still have to be seen in the light of liberation or mukti and bhakti. Right, because dharma, artha, and kama can't be applied if they're not going to be good for liberation. Right? And if they're not going to be good for developing devotion. Does that make sense? So that's the principle. But much of the time it just looks at what will work right now, and it does work right now. But the thing is then you see 6 months down the line, then it falls apart. Now someone who's a really good man may keep on top of it like that. And if they don't mind, then great. But the problem is they have to just see sometimes things get too big and you can't work them out. So you have to, that's why it says there must be a balance. Yes.
As an application to this principle which you just mentioned, could I see the parent having felt the situation, how we deal with ecology? We don't see dharma, and then it's basic art and everything is falls apart, the environment, the water is contaminated.
Yeah, it's artha, but it's just the it means your ethics aspect. It's not even morality. You know what I'm saying? Because your ethics means that it's okay. If I use the chemical fertilizers, then apparently the plants get bigger. I get a bigger result. But the problem is with time, I don't. And with time, the value of what I get is also not worth anything. Because the idea is, you're supposed to be dealing in something that people need, not just in something that makes money. That's the problem with the difference between your Vedic and your how you say? You know, your modern economy. Is Vedic is deal in things that people require. Well, the modern is just make money. But the problem is because they're just making money, they break down the social fabric and then you have a lot more problem. You know what I'm saying? It's like before you'd have, you know, one guy, you know, this, you'd have a problem with one homeless guy around the corner in the back alley that you'd have to keep your eye on that he doesn't come in your shop and steal anything. Right? But now, it's like, you know, example of London, now you've got hundreds of thousands of kids that, you know, would happily burn your shop down. Well, after taking everything, then burn your shop down. Right? And that's because they're following that their same process of economics, but now it comes to the point is that morality has nothing to do with it. Dharma has nothing to do with it. It's just, you know, what gets the work done. So it's easy. There's a bunch of us. There's more of us, less of you. Right? And so, and everybody's doing it. So we come into your shop, take what we want, and leave. That's neat. It's practical. So the kids are just being practical. So the adults are thinking, what's happening to our society? It's falling apart. No, this is taught to them by their parents, by their teachers, by their administrators, by the businessmen, right? Yeah, it means the society taught them this. Just that they're thinking, well, I follow this balance of you know, the economics and the morality, and so therefore there's a limit. But did they ever teach that to the kids? Is there a class in any school that teaches you the balance between, you know, economics and sense gratification and morality? No, they don't. They bring in a few, you know, some priests, some Hare Krishnas, something like that, to give a little talk to the people and all that, you know, just because they notice something's going wrong, but they don't know the connection. So they've taught them this, but they didn't realize this is what they taught. You know what I'm saying? So that's the problem. You have to teach everything together. You know, does that make sense? So that's what's missing. You know, like the Oriental, the modern, if you teach, let's say, you know, you go to some place to learn how to shoot a gun and things like that, you just learn how to shoot a gun. Right? But in the Oriental, you go, that you have to learn character for them to teach you stuff. And the better your character, the more they teach you. You know what I'm saying? The first lesson I saw the other day, they just took in a new group of kids. The first lesson is how to offer respect to others in the group. And what are the levels? Right? You have those who are equal, then those who are senior, and then you have the teachers, and then you have the teacher's teacher. So there's different levels. Like that. Does that make sense? So if that's not there, then, you know, if you can't follow that, then you're not going to be in the class. Does that make sense? So the difficulty is that these things aren't taught. And so then people wonder why it's like this. And they say, that, you know, the new generation is so different. No, they're not. They're exactly the same. You know, the parents do whatever they want, whenever they want, go to the temple program when they feel it's important, that they've got the balance of not too fanatic. And then when their kids only go when they want, which is not when the parents want, and then they ask, why are my kids so different? No, the kids are exactly the same. Just you decided to go once a week instead of every day, and they decided to go only on festivals. But it's the same principle. Principle is exactly the same. But the detail is different, therefore you'll say, oh, it's different. You know, just like we'll say one religion is different from the other. No, it's the detail. The principle is the same. God's God. You know, it's not that. Is that what I'm saying? Don't be around when they don't go to the meetings.
I called the meeting.
Then if you call the meeting, then you tell people that this is not going to happen. You're the chairperson of the meeting, so then you have to say is that, you know, these are the rules. Right? And if they don't, then don't invite them next time. You need your authority, yeah, but the point is then, but why do you need your meeting?
Well, you may help with your service.
Why does that topic come up? Why does the other person come up?
Because it's the same service.
But what has their service got to do with your service, even if it's the same service? Means they're going to do their service, you're going to do your service. So so then what do they have to do with it anyway? History is overrated. You know, unless it's piranhas. That's quite good. No. See, we're not going there. Okay? The point is you're asking what to do about it. We're not talking about if you should feel and your heart should go out and all these different things. That's another question. The question you ask is what to do. So the point is whatever prompts these things to come up. In other words, if it's necessary, then you have to find what starts this and avoid it. Right? Means what topic or what, you know, what key word or phrases starts this and avoid that. And if it's not necessary, then don't have the meetings. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense, but you need the meeting because you want to get things done.
So that's what I said. If you need it, then you avoid what's going to start those discussions. The point is you're calling the meeting, you have to take responsibility. You know? But the point is what makes them say it? See, the discussion is your question. We're going to keep it to this because this is not a shrink session. Is that what to do so it doesn't happen? We're not discussing if it should happen or not, or what you should feel about the other person or not. These are personal things. Those are other questions. You have to ask that as a question. The point is you have to figure out what to do so that it doesn't happen since you called the meeting. If you didn't call the meeting, it's not your responsibility. Then you decide whether you want to be at the meeting or not. But since you called it, it's your responsibility that it doesn't happen. You know what I'm saying? You can say, well, the senior person is doing the blasting. I'm not, but you called the meeting. So you're responsible. I said, don't figure out what it is that makes them say these things. You understand? In these kind of questions, you have to be able to separate the intelligence from the mind. Because the emotions are all these things that come up. But the point is those are after the fact. But the emotions are only a consideration once something's been said. But something just doesn't get said out of nowhere. You're not just sitting there and fine one day and talking about the deities, and then they start talking about something out like that. It's that you've said something, so therefore they spoke in this way. You don't say anything that they don't speak.
Morality.
Then there's Dharma. It's also, morality is also ethics, but it's saying when you're dealing with niti, it has these two sides, ethics and morality. The ethics means what actually is right or wrong for the situation to get done what you want to do. Morality would be whether it's good or not based on the element of Dharma. You know, so you'd have to consider the dharmic element in applying your ethics. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? E, to commit comment that the glories of the holy name of the Lord are exaggerated. Right? Because it's said that by one chanting the holy name that all sin is removed. Like that. So when the Shastras say that, it means it. So if we want to say, no, this is sinful, or this or that, like that, then that's where the offense applies. Right. To interpret the holy name in a deviant way, to make up your own, you know, you force something unnatural onto it. You know, the coffee is black, and that's Krishna, and the cream is white. And that's Radharani, and then when they're mixed, it becomes golden, and that's Gauranga. Right? That's a direct quote from of a head of an Upasampradaya. Just to.
Coffee cup.
Yeah. You understand? So in other words, they're interpreting in so many ways, puts their different things on it. You don't do that. We just avoid it. Six, to commit sinful activities on the strength of chanting the holy name. So this doesn't mean that when something's happened accidentally. This means that I can do this. If I do this, I can chant and get rid of the offense. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? So like that. And accidental doesn't mean that there aren't some plans in the accidental. That's the whole thing. This is the other thing, is there is no such thing as accidental. Because you thought, hey, I'm going to, you know, it came up and it's, I'm going to do this. So there was a plan. No, once it's in a fallen state, then it doesn't matter how many plans you make, it's still in that state. Right? And that may be for a long time. You don't think, oh, there's so many incidents. No, it's one incident. You know what I'm saying? So here it means that you understand that by chanting I can free myself from the sin, so therefore there's no problem in sinning. That's what it means. It doesn't mean that something's happened and then one understands by chanting I'll remove that, and hopefully by doing that then I will retract myself from that by the knowledge of detachment, so it won't happen anymore. Does that make sense? So it's a fine point, but this is also one of those, you know, 100% or zero, you know. Eight, to compare the chanting of the holy name to pious activities. Yeah, so we just think about all the different things we could do, and chanting is one of them, right? Because we generally don't think in terms of, you know, ashwamedha yajnas and all these other auspicious things that you do and stuff like that. Aye, to instruct the glories of the holy name to a person who has no understanding of the chanting of the holy name. Right? So you get somebody to chant and some basic things, but to go on in more detail, you don't. Because if somebody is not interested, or somebody, then they can, it's like you can't say something bad about someone you don't know anything about. Right? But as soon as they know something, now they have something to say that they can speak badly. So that's why one only discusses how much would be useful.
That's a difficult one, isn't it? I got some people chanting while I was in Europe, and I was very insecure in terms of how much should I actually tell them what's actually going on here.
No, it's just it means that you're chanting God's name, and by being associated with God's name, we become purified, become like that. So you don't get so much into the detail.
I was fixed on like the God aspect. Should I talk about that actually?
God's not bad.
No,
it's okay.
I agree.
You agree? Okay. So that's not one of the problems with the others. Like that.
No.
Okay, like that. Okay. God's cool.
Yeah, God's cool.
Yeah, no, it's just a matter. It means the problem is the God's the problem, the Supreme. You know, these are the recommended names of the Supreme for this age. You know, come on, if they can sing songs and dance around, you know, like that about the age of Aquarius, it's not for another 600 years. Then you know, surely they can accommodate that. You know, these are the names for this age. You know, it's like that. So. That's the one advantage I think you have, is that whatever worked back in the 60s, you can still use.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now, in another definition of this, the chant is said to strike the resolution to some people who are like non-believers.
Yeah, to the non-believers, you don't discuss anything.
But the Eric is said to have no understanding.
No understanding, yes. But that also can mean non-believers. No understanding. Or they don't have understanding, so you just give them the basic things. Like Prabhupada would just have them chant, but he'd tell them the basics. You know, this is God's name. You know, like that the Hare Krishna address, that it's from the Brahma Samhita. But, you know, that much can nicely be said. You know, but get into Hari Nam Chintamani with, you know, Bhakta Jose. No, I wouldn't. Yes. Same. Not to awaken in transcendental attachment for the chanting of the holy name even after hearing all the scriptural injunctions, right? So one should be making that determination. You know, as we're seeing is that in the developing or in the process, sadhana bhakti, then you have cultivating the attachment to the holy name and retracting oneself from material endeavors. You know, that distract from that. So, in other words, one has to be trying to cultivate that. If you're only either not working on attachments or only working on attachments, then that's not good. You have to be working on cultivating the attachment to the Lord. There's no way to atone for any of these offenses. It is therefore recommended that an offender at the feet of the holy name continues to chant the holy name 24 hours a day, right? In other words, if you've offended the holy name, there is no atonement. There's nothing you can do about it except to chant the holy name. So in other words, if one's an offender at the holy name, the lotus feet of the holy name, then one should take shelter even more and be more serious and attentive. Like that. Yes?
Can you explain how, because offenses mean it influences their relationship. Can you show how the J influences the relationship?
How J influences what relationship?
The holy name.
Because if you're not trying to awaken attachment to the holy name, but you're still cultivating attachment to material things or cultivating material detachment but not attachment, then why would that be? You know what I'm saying? It's just like this. Let's say you're talking to somebody, right? And they're looking at something on their computer, right? There's some YouTube video going on, okay? Okay? Right? Okay, maybe it's a lecture or something like that. pleasure. So now you come in and you're trying to interact with them. So if they don't pay attention to you and just look at the screen and are fully absorbed in that, would you be comfortable?
Maybe at the first few seconds.
During the first few seconds. And then?
Expected some reaction.
Yeah, but if you're not getting any reaction.
Not nice.
Not nice. Okay, now what happens if they give up their attachment to watching this YouTube tube? Right? But they don't pay any attention to you. They're working very hard. No, I shouldn't be watching that. I should, you know, like this, you know, that. But they're so totally absorbed in not being distracted by watching their computer. But they're not interacting with you.
Same
problem. But that's the person is renounced. He's detached. He's giving up all material, this and that. Right? But he's not cultivating the attachment to the holy name. So the point is one retracts from that to interact. Retraction on its own has no meaning, and staying attached also is pretty useless. Okay, that works. Okay. In other words, the chanting of the holy name makes one offenseless. In the book Nama Kaumudi, it is recommended that if one is an offender at the lotus feet of a Vaishnava, he should submit to that Vaishnava and be excused. Similarly, if one is an offender in chanting the holy name, he should submit to the holy name and thus be freed from his offenses. In this connection, there's the following statement, spoken by Daksha to Lord Shiva. I did not know the glories of your personality, and therefore I committed an offense at your lotus feet in the open assembly. You are so kind, however, that you did not accept my offense. Instead, when I was falling down because of accusing you, you saved me by your merciful glance. You are most great. Kindly excuse me and be satisfied with your own exalted qualities. Right? In other words, then take shelter of the holy name. It is Krishna, so can always the same point can be made. One should be very humble and meek to offer one's desires and chant prayers composed in glorification of the holy name, such as the Ayimuktu Kuleru Pasyamanam and Nibriti Tarsheru Pigyamanat, Srimad Bhagavatam 10.1.4. One should chant such prayers to become free from offenses at the lotus feet of the holy name. Ayimukta Kuleru Pasyamanam is the first verse of Namastika by Rupa Goswami. Like that. And Nibriti Tarsher, that's the Bhagavatam verse. That's the one in the front, always generally in the front of the Bhagavatam. Like that. It means Krishna book, it's in the front. Smaranam. After one regularly performs the process of hearing and chanting, and after the core of one's heart is cleansed, smaranam, remembering, is recommended. In Srimad Bhagavatam 2.1.11, Sukadeva Goswami tells King Parikit, O King, for great yogis who have completely renounced all material connections, for those who desire all material enjoyment, and for those who are self-satisfied by dint of transcendental knowledge, constant chanting of the holy name of the Lord is recommended. Right? You're a gross materialist, you're not, you know, then chanting the holy name is for you. According to different relationships with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, there are varieties of namanu kirtanam, chanting of the holy name, and thus according to different relationships and mellows, there are five kinds of remembering.
No.
As there are varieties of namanu kirtanam, chanting of the holy name, and thus, according to different relationships and mellows, there are five kinds of remembering. So he's saying, as in chanting, there'll be differences. So in smaranam or remembering, like that. These are as follows: A, conducting research into the worship of a particular form of the Lord; B, concentrating the mind on one subject and withdrawing the mind's activities of thinking, feeling, and willing from all other subjects. C, concentrating upon a particular form of the Lord. This is called meditation. D, concentrating one's mind continuously on the form of the Lord. This is called dhruvanusmriti, or perfect meditation. And E, awakening, a likening for concentrating upon a particular form. This is called samadhi, or trance. So this is very interesting, is that he's given these definitions of these levels of meditation. So we see in all of these, you're pulling the mind from something else, but being neutral isn't enough. Then it has to become positive, and then to that degree that it's concentrating on. So you see that there's two things going on at once. There is the attraction for, A, conducting research in the worship of a particular form of the deity. Right? So you're looking at that, but there's not necessarily a retraction from anything else. Then it goes more where that's the only subject, and the other things start to drop off. Right? So it becomes more. Right? And then concentrating upon that particular form. Right? Then it becomes that this is continuously. You're concentrating that particular form when you're concentrating, but then you might be doing something else. But then when it means that's constant, but then when that deepens where there's, here it says a likening, right? A taste for that. Then, so it's the same thing. It's like you become fixed, then there's the taste. Right? So there's always that nishta, then the ruchi. Right? So there's always those two. You're perfectly following it. Then there's the element of it taking on the actual taste. Then it becomes dynamic. Right? Mental concentration upon particular pastimes of the Lord in particular circumstances is also called remembrance. Therefore, samadhi, trance, can be possible in five different ways in terms of one's relationship. Specifically, the trance of devotees in the stage of neutrality is called mental concentration. Right? Just waiting to see if it flies by or not. Okay. No, just wait. Okay, 4, padasevana. According to one's taste and strength, hearing, chanting, and remembrance may be followed by padasevana. One obtains the perfection of remembering when one constantly thinks of the lotus feet of the Lord. Being intensely attached to thinking of the Lord's lotus feet is called padasevana. When one is particularly adherent to the process of padasevana, this process gradually includes other processes, such as seeing the form of the Lord, touching the form of the Lord, circumambulating the form or temple of the Lord, visiting such places as Jagannath Puri, Dwarka, and Mathura to see the Lord's form, and bathing in the Ganges or Yamuna. Bathing in the Ganges and serving pure Vaishnava are also known as Tadiya Upasanam. This is also Padasevanam. The word Tadiya means in relation with the Lord. Service to the Vaishnava, Tulsi, Ganges, and Yamuna are included in Padasevana. All these processes of Padasevana help one advance in spiritual life very quickly. So in other words, the others is you're chanting, you're remembering, but now you're engaging in direct activities because the Lord is the center of your remembrance. So therefore you do things in connection with the Lord. So that may be directly in connection with the Lord or with things that are directly connected to the Lord. Right? So here, then seeing the Lord, touching the Lord, or in connection with, or serving that which is connected, or tadiya of the Lord, the Vaishnavas, you know, the temple, Tulsi, Jamuna, Ganga, like that. So that's all padasevana. So we see it naturally from remembering, then this comes, yes. Yes, you could say is that those elements would come in. So for us, and we're looking at it more from this side, for they, it would also, their acharyas would look at it. But the tendency is then to start looking at the rituals here. But the point is that you're absorbed in thinking of the Lord, so you want to be around the Lord and those things connected to the Lord. Right? So that service then is padasevana. So from remembering. Right? So according to one's taste and strength, hearing, chanting, and remembrance may be followed by padasevana. So that means one's taste and strength. So also it means it will have a variety of what that means. If you do? You go to the holy river to bathe to get rid of your sins.
Yeah, because of the knowledge, not because of the taste. It would not be considered by the seven.
It says according to one's taste. You can also have no taste. That's also a kind of taste. You understand? So it falls under the category padasevana. But the amount of benefit you'll get will be less than if you appreciate that it's connected to the Lord. Does that make sense? Yes.
Maharaj, how is it being intensely attached to thinking of the Lord's lotus feet? How is called padasevana is different from the smarana?
Because then the point is you're going to do something. You're going to apply it. Right? Because you're remembering that that means that element of service is there. I'm saying remembrance is a service. But here then, the remembrance comes in connection with performing a particular service. Is that... You have something?
Yes, maybe followed by
Padasevana.
So
it's
not necessarily.
No, it means Shravana Kirtana Vishnu Smaranam, you may be there. But the point is generally, one, it's not that it has to be, but if the opportunity is there, one would take advantage.
But how is possible when a devotee is practicing this items? There is a Vaishnava, so it's possible not to practice Padasevana.
It means you naturally would.
Yes.
But if you're sitting in some place where there isn't, then you don't have to worry about it.
Yes.
You know, if you're sitting in the back of your van with the heater on up in Lapland, you know, waiting for this shop to open so you can distribute books, then you don't worry about it. There are no Vaishnavs and there is no Tulsi, so you just stick to chanting. You understand? But if you're in the temple, then naturally. Like that. You know, so here it's not you must, because then, you can't do that there. Then, you know, every Sanyasi van will have a Tulsi in the back, you know, like that. Sorry. Is that something? Maybe on the dashboard. That would be a good thing. Yeah, no, that's good. That's good. Yeah, yeah. Pictures are good. Pictures. With the Tulsi. A plant. In a pot.
And it's living in it.
Wow, cool. See, how to save it. Okay, very good. Guess it must get lonely in those trucks. Like that, you have to bring Tulsi along. Archanam. After padasevana comes the process of archanam, worship of the deity. If one is interested in the process of archanam, one must positively take shelter of a bona fide spiritual master and learn the process from him. There are many books for archana, especially Narada Pancharatra. In this age, the Pancharatra system is particularly recommended for archana, deity worship. Right. There are two systems of archana, the Bhagavat system and the Pancharatiki system. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, there is no recommendation of Pancharatiki worship, because in this Kali Yuga, even without deity worship, everything can be perfectly performed simply through hearing, chanting, and remembering and worshipping at the lotus feet for the Lord. Srila Rupa Goswami states, Brigham Maharaj attained salvation simply by hearing, and Sukadev Goswami attained salvation simply by chanting. Prahlad Maharaj attained salvation by remembering the Lord. The goddess of fortune, Lakshmi Devi, attained perfection by worshipping the Lord's lotus feet. Pitu Maharaj attained salvation by worshipping the deity of the Lord. Akura attained salvation by offering prayers. Hanuman by rendering service. Arjuna by establishing friendship with the Lord. And Bali Maharaj by offering everything to the service of the Lord. So by the looks of it here, Rupa Goswami has pointed out that altercation that Pitu Maharaj was worried about between him and Lakshmi got worked out. She still got the Padasevanam and he got the Archanam. Like that. You know, because there was a worry that Lakshmi was going to get upset with him because he wanted to serve the lotus feet of the Lord. But who was in the Bhagavad Gita? Bhagavata system, Archana. Like Mother Jashoda does. You know, wakes Krishna up in the morning, bathes him, feeds him, you know, dresses him, does all these different things. You know, see that he gets, you know, something for lunch, something for dinner. You know, makes nice clothes for him, sees the nice garland, sandalwood paste, all, you know, like that. So that's the Bhagavata system. It's not practiced by Vaidhi Sadhakas. No. Mother Jashoda is doing all those things because she figures if she doesn't feed Krishna, he'll die. You know, we're the ones that go, oh man, I forgot to make the offer. Right? You know? You know what I'm saying? You're driving off down the road, you know, the kids are in, you know, wife's in, all the stuff's in the car, it took you forever, you finally got it, all the arrangements are made, you're driving down the road, you know, and then you just suddenly it hits you, what about the deities? So that's not Bhagavat. No, that's not. If it was Bhagavat, the deities would have been the first ones in the car. Upaya Bhakti? Yes. But Pancharatra is also followed in Vaikuntha. But it'll be followed from that platform of prema. But the expression through the rules is how they like to do things. But Bhagavat simply means is that its inspiration is coming because of the desire to do the service, not because of the rule. Right? Mother Jashoda feeds Krishna 6 times a day because she wants to. Right? We do it because we have to. Right? If it was up to us, you know, isn't one enough? You know, how many times do I have to offer at my house? Right? How many times do you eat? Well, 3 times, so that's your answer. No, but for the deity, isn't just once a year. Yes.
So it seems that Radhana Kirtanam and Smaranam are the basis for Padasananam and Prabhacharam.
You might even find for Bandhanam also. That's what we said before. They're the basis of everything. Everything else is coming as a result after that. But there's a chronology, but at the same time it's based on the quality of the Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam. As that increases, then the quality of the others increase also.
Archanam is also greater than Padasananam because it's inseparable.
Yeah, because you're serving the Lord. It's direct because it means to worship the deity, then you have to also worship the Tadiya. It's called Panchanga Puja. So the fifth item means worship of the Tadiya. That means anything in connection to the deity. So if you do the other parts very nicely, but not that part, the Lord is not very pleased. You know, it's just like, yeah, that makes sense. So even in the worship of the deity, of the 5 main items, worship of the deity includes that the other four have to be performed. All of these great devotees served the Lord according to a particular process, but every one of them attained salvation and became eligible to return home back to Godhead. This is explained in Srimad Bhagavatam. It is therefore recommended that initiated devotees follow the principles of Narada Pancharatra by worshipping the deity in the temple, especially for householder devotees who are opulent in material possessions. The path of deity worship is strongly recommended. An opulent householder devotee who does not engage his hard-earned money in the service of the Lord is called a miser. One should not engage paid brahmas to worship the deity. One does not personally worship the deity, but engage paid servants instead. He is considered lazy, and his worship of the deity is called artificial. An opulent householder can collect luxurious paraphernalia for deity worship, and consequently for householder devotees, the worship of the deity is compulsory. Is how he takes it through. Strongly recommended. He's a miser. He's lazy. It's artificial. Like that, you know. You know, and then finally, it's compulsory.
What about those who doesn't meet the qualification required? Opulence.
Opulence means?
If you're a poor household.
Poor household. How do you define poor? Means he still only has a 17-inch LED. He doesn't have a 54-inch LED yet. He's only got a Nano instead of an iPod. Is this how you're defining? So, something's there. In our Krishna consciousness movement, there are brahmacharis, grihasthas, vanaprasthas, and sannyasis. But the deity worship in the temple should be performed especially by the householders. The brahmacharis can go with the sannyasis to perform, to preach, and vanaprasthas should prepare themselves for the next status of renounced life, sannyas. Grihastha devotees, however, are generally engaged in material activities, and therefore if they do not take the deity worship, their falling down is positively assured. He says it so pleasantly.
Yeah.
It's positively assured. Don't worry, we'll fall down. Are you feeling bad? He fell down and you said, no, don't worry, it's positively assured. Deity worship means following the rules and regulations precisely. That will keep one steady in devotional service. Generally, householders have children, and when the wives of the household... And then the wives of the householders should be engaged and care for the children, just as women acting as teachers care for the children in a nursery school. Grihastha devotees must adopt the archana vidhi or deity worship according to the suitable arrangements and directions given by the spiritual master. Regarding those unable to take to the deity worship in the temple, there is the following statement in the Agni Purana. Any householder devotee circumstantially unable to worship the deity must at least see the deity worship, and in this way he may achieve success also. So here is Agni Purana is also giving that point. By seeing, we get the same benefit. So here is the lifestyle's pancharatric. The special purpose of deity worship is to keep oneself always pure and clean. Grihastha devotees should be actual examples of cleanliness. Right? Because that's the thing. They're supposed to be more clean than brahmacharis. Right? That's the thing. It's supposed to be double the cleanliness, the standard. So then the temple activities, the temple program, you know, either taking part in the worship in the temple or at one's house, you know, in this way, then it's safe. Because that will regulate. Right? Otherwise, one will just cook for oneself. But if one cooks for the deity, then it has some meaning. You know, it's like one will just do whatever one wants in the house, but one has to follow certain regulations, times of getting up or kirtans or different things like this. Something regulates it. Otherwise, if not, everyone will just do whatever they like whenever they like. Right? And then work the deities in around their own schedule. You know, which sounds practical, But technical, I mean, so we take the same line of, you know, directly saying, that is the definition of Grihamedi, where the house is the center and the Lord is worked into that. Householder means the Lord's the center and you work all of your other things around that. It's a difference, right? You know what I'm saying? We like to make it the grihastas, you know, just, you know, a devotee, and the grihamedi is the gross materialistic non-devotee. But for us, I mean, if that's the case, then there'd be no need of having, you know, a whole chapter describing this in the Bhagavatam. Right? Because Bhagavatam's for Paramahamsas. Paramahamsas know what a materialist is. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Yeah. Yes.
What's the difference between worshipping a deity which is installed and not installed?
Technically, there is no such thing as an uninstalled deity. That, I mean, it's a popular thing. You know, it's like Western culture. You have the uninstalled wife and you have the uninstalled wife. And you get the same benefits from both, right? Yeah. You know, the West is that, you know, devotees are hanging out and spend time together and, you know, like that, and, you know, fog up the windows together. You know, all these kinds of things. No one says anything. Like that is considered cool. So there, then when you get married, okay, now, you know, you're being responsible and this and that. And commit yourself and all these things, and you talk in a real low voice because you've been completely, all your enthusiasm is totally crushed. But, you know, like that. So, you know, that kind of thing. You understand? So, is there such a thing as an uninstalled wife? No. So, therefore, there's no such thing as an uninstalled deity. Like that? That makes sense? Excuse me. Yes.
Usually when devotees, they cannot fall, let's say, a group standard to be devoted to fall, they recommend that you worship Krishna.
Yes.
But sometimes when you recommend such solution, the devotees would say, okay, I want to install the deity, so what's the difference between uninstalled deity and the picture? The picture also accepts worship, accepts bhoga and
What's the difference between the picture and the deity if it's uninstalled? Well, pictures don't get dull. Pictures don't need dressing. Right there, there's already two. The picture, if all you do is make your offerings, offer artik, and that's it, they're happy. Because that's all you can do. So you set your standard what you can do. My point is why would you keep something that you can't take care of? You know what I'm saying? This is the point, is that we are irresponsible. We want something. Why? Then my point is if there's no difference, then yes, there's no difference. So they should be happy with the picture. So why are they insisting on the deed? No, but you can dress. So that's the point. If you can dress, then you should dress. You know what I'm saying? If you can't dress a picture and you don't dress it, is there any problem? Will the picture feel bad? No. But if the deity you can dress and you don't dress them, then that's the point. That's the point. So this concept of the uninstalled, it's something very conveniently made up by the devotees. There is no such thing. Shastra doesn't mention it, Prabhupada doesn't mention it, nobody mentions it. But devotees, it's been so easily accepted because it just works for their mundane concept of deity worship, the sentimental concept of deity worship. There's no such thing. You have temporarily installed and permanently installed. That you have. So the temple is permanently installed. Or you may have permanently installed in your house. But temporarily installed would be like this. Okay, you can only worship the deity and dress them and bathe them on a codicil. So you have a set of deities. Right? And every ekadasi, you pull them out, do a proper bathing, dressing, everything like that, and then at night, you put them to rest, and they go back in the box, and they don't come out until next Ekadasi. That's called temporarily installed. But during that time, you follow all the rules. That's temporarily installed. This one where, well, we can only dress them once every Ekadasi. It's like, great, why don't you take bath once every 2 weeks and dress every 2 weeks? No, but that's not practical. So it's not practical for the Archon. Therefore, the picture is just as much a deity as that, but they don't believe that. So it's sentimentalism that they have to have deities. You know what I'm saying? I mean, we've greatly enhanced the livelihood of, you know, the deity makers in Vrindavan, like that, you know. Before, there only used to be a few of them. You know, now there's, you know, there's so many like that. But, you know, so we've definitely done that service. We've definitely helped Brajvasis and everything like that. But as far as the deity worship goes, and that's not... it's not real. So the point is if one is initiated and one is working at that standard, what's the meaning? Right? But now what will happen? Someone who's a little bit more dealt with it, now they'll say, no, but then Prabhupada said, you know, there's this Gorni Thai that you could have them and then give them out to all the karmis and all that. That'll be the first thing they'll say. Yeah, that's karmis. And then when they're initiated, then they'll work at the same standard of one stick of incense. You know what I'm saying? So they're trying to take what the karmis would do. Like the karmi, he's still smoking, drinking, having illicit sex, and possibly even gambling. He's come to the temple, took prasad, and is chanting, you know, in the kirtan. So you'll say that's progressive for him, right? Now, what happens if a devotee is initiated and he's doing those, breaking those four? Will we say that's progressive? So therefore it doesn't apply. So the point is, as deity worship, it says here, is for the grihasthas to regulate their life. Nobody wants to be regulated. No one wants authority. No one wants anyone to tell them what to do. That's the disease. So therefore, then, you know, you either have proper worship at your house or go to the temple. Proper worship's going on. You don't have to do anything. Agni Purana says, if by circumstance you can't do it, then you go to the temple and see there, and you get the same benefit. You'll get more benefit going to the temple, seeing the deity that has been bathed and dressed, than staying at home and worshipping your deity that you don't bathe and dress. Does that make sense? Yeah, because the shaligram comes that size so you can offer everything. You don't offer, why would you have? But it's just, it's a fashion, just something, it's a sentiment. Oh, I would like. But that's the thing. They're thinking it is Vaishnav, how do you say, it is the Vaishnav spontaneity and devotional service when actually it's simply Protestantism. It's nothing to do with Vaishnava at all. It's just the Protestant, whatever I feel like, I do. Because the Vaishnava is, I'm spontaneous within following the rules. Protestant is, I don't have to follow the rules, there is no authority, I just do whatever I feel like. There's a difference. Maybe subtle. But different. Huh? Quite obvious for some. Yes.
You're watching the arti in the temple. You're not actually watching the articles. You're just looking at the deities, trying to focus your mind on the deities. You have to actually watch each article.
No, but it's the devotee is now, like, let's say the devotee is offering something to Krishna, right? As service. What's Krishna's response? Yeah, he's happy. So the point is, if you see Krishna during the arti, then that's the point. Right? No, otherwise, you're sitting there and watching. Oh, I missed one. Right? You come home, feeling bad. What's wrong? You know, it's like that. I missed one of the circles, you know. Something, son, got distracted. I looked, I missed a circle. Everybody knows that should go. That would be funny. Yeah. No, it's not important. You watch Krishna. It means naturally you're going to see the lamp in that also, but it's not that you're watching the lamp. You put it down, now it's moving around the temple.
What is the, what would be the balance between, like, now people can serve the same things you cannot do immediately, so we are, and deity worship also, you're trying to get there. So what would be the balance between, you
can't do start with the picture, and then when it gets more balanced, then get deities. That would be the balance.
So it's like the outline, or not.
Let's be a little direct here. Would you be comfortable with your teenage daughter, you know, off on the side there talking to some teenage boy? No. So then why would the deity be comfortable? You're not taking, what's the problem? Now if that boy is the daughter's fiancé, he's committed that he's going to marry this girl. Do you have any problem? No. So that's the point. Installation means you're committed. That's all. Uninstalled means I may worship, but what if I don't feel like it or I can't? You know, the family's, my wife's been badgering me for the last 3 years about going to Bali this, you know, vacation and all this and that. And, you know, so that means that during that 2 weeks, and, you know, we'll try to do what we can, that neighbor devotee will come over and, you know, change the water or something like that, do a mental offering, and, you know, like that. So, you know what I'm saying? So one feels that one has no real responsibility. That's the problem with uninstalled. It's not that it's an arch or not. The problem is a lack of commitment. So the point is just as a shaligram, you can offer 64 items. The reason for the archa, you know, in the small size, is that it has a bath. Of all the 16 items for the deity, the archa, the bath is the most important, right? So the bathing and dressing is the most important because that's what's different between them and the picture. You know what I'm saying? When the deity is in the form of the yantra, then it's all about the mantras because the deity is made of mantras. So it's all about the mantras that you recite and do. So the archa, the thing, is the bathing and dressing. So if you don't bathe and dress, why would you have? You know what I'm saying? It's just like, you know, the person's an enthusiast and goes out and buys some gizmo or gadget that he can't use and may never use, but it just feels good that he has one, you know, because everybody else has got one. But much of the time, that's what's happening. Pictures work really good. I mean, if it didn't work really good, then, you know, basically Russia and a lot of those countries in the East, they only worship pictures. They don't worship deities. You know, Catholicism has deities, but East Orthodox doesn't. Orthodox has pictures. And they don't feel it's any less of a representation. Right?
Yes. So maybe we should introduce in this kind of worshipping yantras by mantras, like something new and good and
I thought you were going to say, being, you know, intellectually sarcastic, maybe we should introduce into ISKCON the concept of worshipping a picture, you know, something new and not been done, you know, hasn't been done since the 70s, you know, like that, you know. Let's go retro here, you know. Advaitacharya, his deity is a picture. Of course, it was painted by Vishakha Devi, you know, but it's a picture. So the point is the deity means you can do all these other things. If you're not interested, don't do. Why have deities? You know, if your main thing is you're going to offer artik and offer boga, and that's it, then you'd like to bathe and dress, but you're not regularly going to do it, and you can't even guarantee that, then don't get deities. You know? Does that make sense? You know. That's the point.
Going back one point. So commitment is the standard. Would you get levels in commitment?
You just have to take it back to the example I gave. But what are you looking for? It means that he's going to, you know, he's going to take care of everything, right?
Yeah. I mean, an example of the fiancé, right? And the teenage daughter.
So you're going to be happy he only feeds her, you know, on the codices. So the rest of the time, he doesn't. He keeps her in the closet and pulls her out on the codices. Dresses her up really nice, feeds her really good.
So that would be another commitment, right?
But that's an uninstalled deity. So that means during those 2 weeks that you're not worshiping, they are asleep in a box somewhere. You know, you can't have have them out and look at them at the same time not do anything. You know what I'm saying? You want to look at it, you got to pay. Right? The girl dresses up. You know, you're just going to get by and just sit and smile. You know, you got to get out your credit card there. You know, you're going to buy stuff. You're going to feed it. You know, it's going to happen. You understand? It's just relationships. The point is we're talking about, I don't want to follow the rules, but we're trying to break it down to just a rule. Like, how much can I do it? Okay. You know, if I have to do it, how much the minimum I can get by with, you know? Okay. Yes, but the minimum is whatever you do every day. That's the minimum, right? Means it can just be some water quickly that you bathe, you know, just simple dress. It might even be the same clothes every day. But the point is it's every day. That's the meaning of nitya. Because if you don't do it every day, it's naimittic, which means occasional. So if it's occasional, which means temporarily installed, then you have to choose what is how do you fix occasional. You know what I'm saying? You know, just like Janmashtami is occasional. It's not every day. Ekadasi is occasional. So naimittic seva is very much part of our process. But having the deity, and, you know, then it's how much you're going to do every day. That's what's important. So there must be a minimum every day that includes the 16 items. Like that. That's the basic thing. So 16 items daily, how much you can do for that, that's there. Somebody is bathing their deities in Panchamrita. Someone can only do it in water. Someone brings water from here and there and does a long bath with all mantras. Someone else is very simple. Someone else has so much elaborate arrangement of clothes and jewelries and this and that. Someone else doesn't. But it's still, it's daily. That's the point. That's the difference between the two. Is the one is occasional, but when you're not, means they're not on the altar. Just like you ever seen the small Radha Madhava? Right? And so when do you see him on the altar? Yeah, or some other program. If there's a program, then they wake them up, they do the full puja, and then they're on the altar. Right? And then when they put them to rest, then they go back and you don't see them until the next. But it's not that they sit there all week and you don't do anything for them. That's the point. Temporarily means when you're going to pay attention, then they come out of the box. And when not, they don't. It is a kind of Utsav Murti, yeah. But it's not the one that you bathe the deity every day through, or feed him through, or put him to rest and wake him up through. Right? It means for your naimittic sevas.
I have one more practical question. If you have like a Shalyam Shila, can you create Bodhitai and change and do the 16 items in the Shalyam?
Yes, it means if you have a Shaligram, he gets bathed every day. Then the deities only have to be wiped off and then put to clothes. Like that. That's fair. But then that goes together. But then it should be, you know, something, all the 16 items and everything nicely. You know, I mean, once you look at the 64 items, that's the whole point. All these little things can be done. So it's not also just the sentiment. You know, and then they'll say, oh, Govardhan, you don't have to do. But Puri Maharaj mentioned it was, you know, an authority in these things. Prabhupada, you know. So then, he said, if if Shaligram is there and Govardhan Shila, so the Shaligram's accepting all the technical worship. So then Giriraj basically just bathe them and dress them nicely and everything like that. But if there's no Shaligram, then he is like the Shaligram. So all the 16 items and everything has to be done. That's just the way.
If you're traveling.
In a train, for example. If you're traveling in a train. A Shaligram traveling on the train.
What would be the proper way?
Why would he be traveling on a train? Why do you travel on the train if you have a Shaligram?
You want to go somewhere.
You want to go somewhere. It's also flying. You do your puja and all that, put them in the box, go to the airport, get on the plane, get to the other side, take them out, set them up again.
Yes, that's clear. But
if you're in the train, what was your thought before you got the Shaligram? What was your plan? That's my point.
Somebody gave it.
Yeah, but before you accepted it, then what were your thoughts? What service you were going to do? When you took up the worship, what did you tell him you're going to do when you're traveling? I see. And so what does Manasa Puja mean? All the items. Every last one. Yeah, can be done. But see, the thing is we're not looking for... See, have we noticed the line of questions here? They're all looking for loopholes. It's all loophole questions. What's the minimum I can do? What can I get away with? This and that. It's not actually on the point of how to cultivate that attachment to Krishna. You know, it's not on how to become renounced, because renounced means I got to give something up and spend more time for the deity. So it's not that either. You know, it's how I can spend the minimal amount of time in the deity, but get the full maximum benefit that I imagine I'm getting. Right? Does that make sense? So this is the problem. So that's why it's not what you consider ideal in deity worship. Because the deity worship is supposed to be, as is there, is how to regulate someone, how to engage one. You know, it says the householder has all kinds of facilities, so he gets distracted by that. So these facilities are therefore used for the deity. Right? Because when the brahmacharya gets married, okay, just what is one of the things he considers?
What
deity
he's going to have.
Yeah, okay, deities, but just come back just in general. I mean, so what are the opulences of being a grihastha? He'll see it. We're not talking about someone who actually understands. We're talking about what is this idea. Right? He doesn't. No temple commander. He can do whatever he wants, whenever he wants. His time is his time. He doesn't have to get the money. Is his money. His facilities are his. He does with them. You know, before it was, you know, pick that up, put it in here, clean this. But no, now he can do whatever he wants. So his time, his money, his facilities are his. He can do whatever he wants with them. But now, if brahmacharya is called an ashram, then how would you define grihastha's ashram unless there's a similar regulation? Difference is, instead of the temple commander telling you what to do, you're supposed to be mature and you know what to do, so you do it. The only reason the brahmacharya cleans the floor is because the temple commander tells him to. But the grihastha knows it's supposed to have a clean floor, therefore he cleans it himself. That's why he says he's an emblem, example. Actual examples of cleanliness, right? The brahmacharya is not known to be an example of cleanliness, no offense here, right? Like that. But if you were, how you say, if you were French and a brahmacharya, then you could get both, right? You know, that's, does that make sense? Otherwise, he always gets it for the French thing, and you get it for the French. Yeah. Okay. Does that make sense? So the point is not what's the minimum we can get by with, but what's the actual purpose? So what do I have to do to obtain that purpose? Right? You know, it's just like, just to be honest, in all the years of discussing deity worship, that with someone in home worship, it's always been these kind of questions. It's always exactly the same questions. Like that. No, absolutely no difference. Like that. But today I had one different one. Like that. It was his question that brought to the point of, you know, what's the bottom, you know, what's the responsibility? That was, today was that was a progress. You know, we actually, you know, it's daily commitment that makes it. But I've never had that. No, they're always just, what's the minimum we can get by with, but in their mind think I'm getting the full benefit. You know what I'm saying? It's just like, you know, that's there. It's just, they don't understand is you're going in and you go into the store, what's the minimum I can buy? Okay, you know, they have some limit, you know, like that 10 cents or whatever it is like that. But, you know, is it a full meal? But so if you think your 10 cents is going to get you as much as, you know, 10 bucks, it's not going to happen. So that's the point. Is if the attitude is what's the minimum, one's going to get the minimum. You know? The point is that what is the actual fundamentals I'm supposed to accomplish? And then I'll do that according to my means. If I have less means, it'll be less. If I have more means, it'll be more. You know? But this is the first time it's like, no, okay, daily. Because it's always a fight of, well, can I do it? You know, what about this? You know, the codicils, can I do it that? What about, you know, or sometimes you get once a week. You know, well, during the week I'm very busy, you know, job, this, that, so many things, got to drop the kids off to school, you know, got to eat breakfast, you know, all these different things. You know, the thought that you could fast, you know, that just doesn't register. You could get up a little earlier. It means you could not watch that one more, you know, of, you know, episode of the series and go to bed early and get up a little early. No, that's not part of it. No, I have to unwind and, you know, this and that. Like this. So it's just like, you know, hey. Does that make sense?
Trying to put not loophole
question. Trying to put not loophole. Okay. A non-loophole question.
Isn't the picture of the deity in the same category of permanent deity as the...
Can be.
But does it imply that it has to be installed permanently?
Are you going to bathe it and everything?
The bathing only applies to the permanent.
No, it applies to the archer. You're saying like you're installing a yantra, you don't do everything that you do for an archer either.
So the picture then is what kind of deity?
It is permanent. It's one of the eight kinds of deities. It can be permanent, it can be temporary. You know what I'm saying?
So it has to be actually properly installed also, the picture?
No. The point is this, it's a different consideration. You know, saying it works on different principles. For the picture, it's whatever you can do. It means, in other words, what everybody wants out from a deity, the picture is the perfect medium. But they know it has to be this. You know what I'm saying? Like that. You know, you come into the watch shop, look at these things, and you know, I have 50 euros, you know, like that, and I'd like to get a watch, you know, and I show you. Yeah, okay, here, you know, here's some. You know, watches you can buy and all that. And says, well, that's nice, but I really like that gold Rolex over there. You know, like that. You know, says, no, the 50 bucks I'll get, you can get this. No, but, you know, I really feel, my, you know, I really would like it, you know, if I could have it. You know, so we don't buy it in economics. But it's perfectly does what you want. You want to go away on vacation, the picture just sits there. It doesn't worry about it. Right? Like that. In fact, maybe you can even take the picture with you. But the point is the picture doesn't worry about it. You know? So they function as permanently installed when you're there, but when you're not, they're not. So when you're there at the temple, like when the devotees are at the temple, you do all the worship that you will do, whatever's established. But if they decide that there's some big program happening somewhere, everybody in the temple gets in the van and drives off, and that's it. You lock the door and don't worry about it. You know, these are advantages. But we want those advantages with it. It's impossible. Right? It said, yeah. It does what they want to do. Right? Right. It's like the water pots. They're deity. That's another form of the deity in water. So they're deities, you know. And they're there. You just set them up for that day, and then afterwards they're gone. But you treat them properly. That's why when the yajna is finished, you don't come and take the coconut off the pot, because it's a deity. You just walked off with his head, you know. You're supposed to wait until everything's taken apart and all that, and then you can get your coconut. You know what I'm saying? So each form has its what's important, what you can do. Prabhupada's idea is that technically no one should really have their own deities. It was supposed to be only if you couldn't attend the temple. Like, I remember, I think it was Vamanadeva, him and his wife, they had deities. They were the only grihasthas that I ever knew of that had deities. Because they lived quite far away. And so then on Sunday they would come and bring their deities, which they do full worship, and they bring their deities and bring to the temple, so their deities would be on the altar, so the Sunday program and offering was to their deities, because we just had a picture. So generally Prabhupada didn't appreciate that pujaris had their deities and then had their own at home, you know, worship the main deities. But that's specifically, you know, brahmacharis. Brahmacharis don't need really to have deities. Grihasthas, if there's a facility, if it's there, then it could be there. But it is possible, if that's worked out, is that's what you do. So if you're not worshipping the main deities, you worship them. But then it should be a regular thing. It shouldn't be that, you know, one day here and then one day like that. You know, it's like if you worship the deities there once a week, you dress them or something like that. It's not that day you don't take care of your deities. But if it's going to be, you know, 7 days a week you're doing pujari service in the temple, then you could make some arrangement like that. Does that make sense? But you'd have to work that out with them.
Yes. Many persons have pictures of Krishna in non devotees, and also many persons have idols of Krishna.
What is the position of the manifestation of the deity? Means according to someone's surrenders, how much Krishna reciprocates.
But still, we consider that those deities should be worshipped in each one.
We would consider that the pictures can sit there, but the deity should be put away. Right? It means anybody can have a picture of Krishna on the wall. Nice. You know, better than having, you know, some Dutch countryside, you know, one seagull flying by. You know, some impressionist painter or something like that. Or a framed ear or something like that.
Airbrush for Ferrari from the 80s. Airbrush for Ferrari from the 80s.
Yes. Yeah. make sense? Oh. Okay. Okay. It's a big section. So tomorrow we get into all the offenses to the deities. More fun. Yes. That's the difficulty. Gita doesn't deal with these elements, so again, all issues.
Well, that's why I'm in the Gita.
Yeah, yeah.
Om Hare Krishna, 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 Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, 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 Hare Hare.
Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Jainatai Gaura Premanandi.